Welcome to Understanding the Times Web Bonus with Jen Markell and Eric Barger. Today, Jen and Eric will be talking with Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann about the issues surrounding the Benghazi incident, where four Americans lost their lives. Thanks for joining us for this web bonus. Here now is Jen Markell.
You never want a serious crisis to go to waste. And what I mean by that, it's an opportunity to do things that you think you could not do before. And this crisis provides the opportunity for us, as I would say, the opportunity to do things that you could not do before.
What this began as was a spontaneous, not a premeditated, response to this very offensive video that was disseminated. It began spontaneously in Benghazi, sparked by this hateful video. This was not a pre-planned, premeditated attack. That what happened initially was that it was a spontaneous reaction to what had just transpired in Cairo as a consequence of the video. This is a response to a hateful and offensive video.
This video is disgusting and reprehensible.
Crude and disgusting video sparked outrage throughout the Muslim world. I know there are some who ask, why don't we just ban such a video? The answer is enshrined in our laws.
Our country does have a long tradition of free expression, which is enshrined in our Constitution and our law. Now, I know it is hard for some people to understand why the United States cannot or does not just prevent these kinds of reprehensible videos from ever seeing the light of day.
I know that not all countries in this body share this particular understanding of the protection of free speech.
There are, of course, different views around the world about the outer limits of free speech and free expression.
But in 2012, at a time when anyone with a cell phone can spread offensive views around the world with a click of a button, the notion that we can control the flow of information is obsolete.
Note that in today's world, with today's technologies, that is impossible.
The future must not belong to those who slander the Prophet of Islam. Prophet of Islam. Prophet of Islam. Prophet of Islam.
Oh my, cover up, lies, deceit. Supposedly wise people sounding like utter fools. What do we make of this? I'm really not sure. One thing is for sure, we're in the last of the last days. Eric, when I hear some of these sound bites, and we've heard them now for over an hour, we've heard Michelle Bachmann, you've had some other just mind-blowing. I feel like I'm going to melt down here any minute because of all of this information. It's almost too much to process.
Well, that's the way I felt, as I may mention on radio, that the amount of this stuff, the overwhelming amount of websites I've looked at mm-hmm. and information I've read, both from left-wing and right-wing sources, and then going to the United Nations and listening to YouTube clips, I have felt like a walking research machine over the last two or three weeks doing this.
What prompts you to have such passion in this research?
I think this is a big story, and there's so many unanswered questions, and Michelle Bachmann said the same thing. And this is what got me into talking with her about it, because she's very passionate about this too. We wonder, was this a CIA outpost? They call it a consulate. But was it more than that? Why was there a huge warehouse there that the CIA was in charge of? What was going on? And there is speculation, and that's all we can do because we're not getting any answers from anybody in the White House. Was there some sort of an arms collection or even arms smuggling, maybe to Syria, going on? Were they recruiting jihadist fighters to send to Syria? I mean, I don't think the administration wants anybody to know about this. This is the CIA kind of working behind the scenes. It does sound like Iran-Contra, doesn't it?
Well, it's I'm kind of at a loss for words. I've actually been following Benghazi on a daily basis, and the kind of the conclusion by many is, and I have to give some credit here to the Fox News investigative team, there is gun running that was a part of this. That was not a consulate, by the way, that building. It was a U.S. building, but it was not an official consulate. Interestingly, Ambassador Stevens was meeting with the Turkish ambassador that night, and the kind of the conclusion is that perhaps the gun running was going through Turkey into Syria. And that's why the Turkish ambassador was there for some sort of a consultation. We also get into some rumors of hostages, swapping hostages, October surprises, and things like that. And some of this will probably come out in a book someday.
Yeah, I would think so. And again, you know, if folks are worried that we're now into rumors and speculation, we don't have anything else to go on except the fact that major news sources such as Fox News have reported some of the things you just mentioned. You know, I think besides what was going on at that facility, that consulate, whatever the words they want to use for it, besides what was going on before September 11th, what happened the night of the attack? First of all, we get the story for 2 weeks that it was a movie trailer. You just heard the clips we just played, that it was a movie trailer, a spontaneous demonstration that turned into something deadly where 4 Americans were killed. But do you come, as we've heard many of the conservative pundits say, do you come to a demonstration with rocket-propelled grenades and machine guns? And I heard John McCain say that, Senator McCain. So, you know, that's a question. Heavy weapons and mortars, do they show up at spontaneous demonstrations? And why did it take the terrorists, and that's what they were, over 4 hours before they finally set fire to flush Ambassador Stevens out? That's assuming that they were trying to take a hostage, because they could have destroyed the building in a few minutes with mortars and RPGs, but they didn't do that. Whether they were doing that only to terrorize someone, that is by prolonging the attack, I can't say. But why did it take so long? And then they set the building on fire instead of trying to use weapons against it. Ambassador Stevens died of asphyxiation. So were they trying to take a hostage? Was there going to be some sort of a hostage swap? That's been talked about. Were they going to swap Ambassador Stevens for the blind sheikh? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's all kinds of things. Was that going to be the October surprise to make President Obama look like the greatest diplomat that the world has ever known? Until the White House fills in the details, Jan. Mm-hmm. And this is the thing that I believe Michelle Bachmann is looking for, and I'm certain that many other in Congress are looking for it too. Then all we're left is to wonder and to question what was going on.
You have some more interview time with her here that we need to get to.
Yeah, and it's this is really important stuff, and we've put all of our conversation about Benghazi and Libya and the idea that there's a cover-up all in this next segment. So let's go ahead and go to that right now.
All right.
You know, there's a lot of other things that the media is curiously silent about today, isn't there?
That's right. In regard to what we've seen with Benghazi and Libya, again, there's a thread here that needs to be pursued. There's been very little attention that's been put on this issue. I hope sometime we could even devote an entire show to what happened in Libya and Benghazi. This is one of the most horrific actions that has taken place, and the story virtually hasn't been told. And part of this deals with this whole very weird, strange narrative that the White House was trying to promote after we saw the deadly attacks, which included the killing of our ambassador in cold blood. The Obama administration continued to pursue this false narrative that this was an anti-Islamic video that motivated this attack. They said that it was spontaneous. It certainly wasn't. And almost immediately, the White House knew that that narrative wasn't true, and yet they made that their cause celeb, that that's what they were going to talk about. Now, also realize that as they're pushing this false narrative, the very next weekend is when the United Nations came together for their General Assembly. That was September 25th. They came together, and the only thing they talked about was criminalizing anti-Islamic speech. Isn't it odd that on September 11th, we had this horrific murders and burning of our mission in Benghazi, and the White House floats this false narrative of the anti-Islamic video as the reason? And even despite, this is almost 2 weeks later now, the president went to the United Nations on September 25th, and in his remarks, after the administration clearly knew the video was not the primary motivation for the attacks, the president continued 6 times in his speech to talk about the anti-Islamic video as the motivating factor behind the attack. Why? That's what I want to know. Why? Why did the president and the administration and his UN ambassador, Susan Rice, why did they continue to make their story that it was the anti-Islamic speech that was the reason for Libya, when clearly it wasn't. Now they're trying to backpedal and say, no, 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 they said that it was terrorism. Well, they didn't. TV doesn't lie. We have a memory and a recording. This is very serious about what happened. There's a lot of questions that have to be addressed. We still don't know where the president was when the attack happened. We don't know when he found out. We didn't know what he ordered. Can you imagine this? For the first time in 30 years, we have an ambassador that's been killed on duty, in the line of duty. And no one's even asked the president, when did you find out? Where were you? What did you order in response to that? And why did you continue this false narrative for weeks after you clearly knew this wasn't about the video, this was a terror attack? This is very, very serious. And so we need to know, with the President of the United States, what is his view on criminalizing anti-Islamic speech? These are very serious questions, and they deserve to be answered.
Oh, and that stuff needs to be asked for sure. And you know, with very few exceptions, the media is silent about this. I thank God for the reporting that was done on Fox News and for the way Jake Tapper has tried to hold Jay Carney's feet to the fire on this. But, you know, they are obfuscating every time they get a chance. And I've been reading about this and following this and actually writing an article that deals with this and, of course, preparing for this radio program for now about a month. And all of these questions have come through my mind, everything you brought up and said so eloquently and laid out that case.
There's really three key areas that have to be addressed regarding the Benghazi situation that hasn't been addressed. And the first one is the lack of security at this mission in Benghazi. It was not a consulate, it was a mission. But what a lot of people don't realize is that the security was so poor in Benghazi, and the people who were in Benghazi were begging for American security, not only for the ambassador, but for the others that were working there. There were requests for additional security in March, in June. There were 16 Americans on the ground, and this was the hellhole, if you will, of the entire Middle East. This is an extremely dangerous area. Not only was additional security denied, but the security that we had, the American security, was completely pulled. This was a deteriorating situation, and essentially the security was put in the hands of local Libyan militia. And so we were trusting American security to local Libyans who just until a few months ago were being ruled by Muammar Gaddafi and who had the influence of the Muslim Brotherhood and of known al-Qaeda militia in that area. Again, this is the part of Libya where the recruits came, the highest number of recruits, to kill American soldiers in Iraq. And we're allowing local Libyan militia to provide our security. So just consider, on the night of September 11th, our ambassador was being protected by a few local Libyan militia. And then consider that President Obama sent down the Sunday morning shows the following Sunday after the murder of our ambassador. She stated that there was substantial security presence for the ambassador in Benghazi, when clearly that was false. We left that ambassador virtually naked from a security point of view. That in itself is incomprehensible. But then the second line of questioning needs to be about the security assistance that was requested by those that were under fire. We know that there were a few that were in that mission. We know that for 7.5 hours, they were calling for help from the United States government to help them when they were under fire. Now, this is unthinkable. Here we had our ambassador, and there were cables, there were emails, there were phone calls within literally minutes of them coming under fire. And these requests went to some of the highest decision makers in the country. So our highest decision makers knew that our ambassador was under siege. And yet, for 7.5 hours, no one was sent in there to help them. We find out later that it took 20 hours for the United States military to even land at an air base in Italy. That's incomprehensible. When we have less than 2 hours away, in some cases an hour away, we have planes, we have military hardware that's available to help these people. And we don't even know at what point the military even went on site to secure the mission in Benghazi.
Well, we do know that CNN found highly security documents, stuff that should have been secured, on the scene weeks later. You know, I said the next day after all this came out that if I was a Foreign Service officer, I would have written my letter of resignation the next day, because if they did that to those guys in Benghazi, am I next? That would have been the question.
Well, that's right, because our government wasn't there to help our American personnel. They weren't there to help them when they were crying for help before the attack, and they weren't there to help them during the attack, again, for 7.5 hours. Now, here's the other thing. This is shocking. This happened on September 11th. It took until October 4th for the FBI to even get on the ground to even begin an investigation and secure the sovereign soil. That American compound is American sovereign soil. Why were we delayed? Why couldn't they get in? What other sensitive documents went missing? If the ambassador's personal diary went missing, if CNN were the ones who were somehow able just to walk right in, where was America? We consider ourselves to have the finest intelligence, the finest law enforcement, the finest military, and the finest FBI investigators, and they wait until October 4th to even go in? I'm telling you, something smells very bad. And the media is not talking about this, and the president's not answering any questions. And that's why this is so very vital to know. Why did the administration continue to peddle this false narrative that the deadly attacks were based upon a spontaneous event motivated by an anti-Islamic video? Hands out, it's not true. The president continues to peddle this false story at the UN nearly 2 weeks later, six times nonetheless. And his administration continues to push that narrative. Egypt continues to push that narrative. They're run by the Muslim Brotherhood today. So this is very concerning. We cannot stop asking these questions because, like you said, Eric, what Foreign Service officer, what man in the military or woman in the military or person in the FBI or in any of our other protective services, what protections would they have or how would they feel secure if America wasn't there for them before the attack, during the attack? And clearly it appears that our government was falsely stating, in fact, some may even say lying, about what the event was after the attack. And still, the president to this day hasn't been asked, Mr. President, where were you when you found out about this? What did you do? Did you go in the... We know he was in the White House.
I was going to say, we know where he was when Osama bin Laden was killed.
We do, because you're exactly right, Eric. They couldn't wait to get the information out about killing Osama bin Laden. But we know the president was in the White House. We know within an hour, the president was having a meeting with the Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, with Vice President Biden in the White House. The Situation Room is in the White House. And we also know that there was full coverage available on what was going on in Libya to the president. He had the information. We don't know what the president did or when he did it. We have no idea. But we do know that for 7.5 hours, Americans were under attack, and their government did not go to rescue them.
Yeah,
this is unthinkable.
That is unthinkable. That is the bottom line right there. It is unthinkable. And, you know, I won't ask you to speculate about this. I'm a commentator, so I'll get to do that. But there, it appears to me that there was something else going on. And another reason, there's another reason for why this has not been made public knowledge. There's another reason why that this was a CIA operation. I don't know if we'll ever get to the bottom of this. Somebody knows, that's for sure. And I hope that that you all in the intelligence community will really dig in on this, and I know you are, and I hope others will have a moment of conscience and just say, you know, this has to come out. I believe there's a much bigger story behind the scenes that the administration probably doesn't want anybody to know about, and that's my own personal feelings about it. And it is stunning, the talking points that have gone on and on and on, and how long it lasted. It wasn't a day, it was 2 weeks, as you just said. So, you know, I think we also need to be aware that in late November, the UN summit to usher in more internet regulations is underway. And so all of this stuff, the UN wants countries to control speech on the internet. All of this works together. It's bad news for freedom of speech. It's bad news for religious free speech for sure, because it's all fueled about those who want to stop the defamation of Islam. That in itself, that word, the defamation of Islam, they've switched from that to the idea that this is now a hate crime. And I believe that is what's fueling this, that Nation states who want mouths shut concerning this have now realized that they can make this a hate crime to speak out about the Prophet Muhammad, about the Quran, about Islam in general.
And the word crime is the operative word. This is what we need to realize. Again, it's like I said before, once you take away people's ability to be able to speak, this is not a small right. This is everything. It is game over, because then all of the power and authority has been given over to the Islamist. The Islamist is the only one who gets to write, who gets to dictate what we can say and what we can do and what we can print and what we not print and who can assemble and how they can assemble. Because at that point, Sharia Islamic law, in effect, becomes the law of the land, because the Islamist gets to have the authority, not anyone who opposes Islam. This is a very, very important issue.
I hope the listeners are hearing this and understanding the gravity of the situation. Folks, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Representative Michelle Bachmann. I'm on the phone with her. This is Eric Barger. This is Understanding the Times, and we're dealing with free speech, religious free speech, in particular, how Islamists around the world are using different mechanisms to try to curtail religious free speech, especially that about Islam. Ms. Bachmann, I sure appreciate you being with us today, and you've got to come back, and we've got to do this again. We could do a whole program on Benghazi, I'm sure, and as things go along, please keep us updated, if you will.
I absolutely will, Eric. Again, it is such a privilege, and I just want to say that I have so much respect for you, for Jan, for Larry, for everyone who is on the program, for Jill. You do a marvelous job, and I thank you so much for addressing this important subject. And thank you to your listeners for supporting this station as well.
Well, we're thrilled with your kind words and just with knowing you and having the contact with you, and we appreciate what you're doing for the country. Thanks so much.
God bless. Thank you.
Well, I can guarantee we'll have a follow-up program, as Michelle Bachmann sort of requested, whether it just focus on Benghazi or some related issues as well. We'll do that in the coming weeks. And Eric, you deserve a go to the head of the class here for your weeks and weeks of research. Excellent interview.
Well, you know, what we've discussed here today is really just pieces in a larger puzzle. This is about liberty, about our freedoms, about the millions of people who are being swayed back and forth because they don't have all the facts to be able to make good decisions with. You know, we could have brought in the Fast and Furious problem,
yeah,
and all kinds of other things, the executive orders. And please hear me, everybody. This is not about Democrat or Republican. If it was a Republican administration and this stuff was going on, these shenanigans, I'd be saying the same thing. This is about freedom. It's about America. It's about our Constitution. It's about who we are as a nation and who we've been the last 200 plus years. I just want you to stop and imagine if the things we talked about both on radio and in this bonus podcast, if any of these things are close to accurate, and I believe they are without any doubt, can you imagine Sunday sermons across our land soon being scrutinized by a panel of religious examiners to see if the words used pass the left-wing litmus test or the Muslim litmus test or however it's viewed, and to see if they become hate crimes, or to see if some or who would be called a renegade preacher is really just inciting his people? I mean, that's where we're going. And eventually, that's exactly the case Antichrist will make against people who disagree with him and who would stand against him and stand against everything that he will stand for. The thought police have now moved to the mouth, and I think we need to see that and understand it. How soon will our legal ability to witness, to defend the faith, and to preach the unadulterated gospel be hampered or stopped? Now, this is the important question, you see. And whether it's a perceived crisis or a real crisis, if we who preach the gospel can be put in a position where we are, our effect is lessened, we are hampered, we are held back, or we're jailed. And folks, we've talked about these things for a long time. Anybody who has studied the end time events knows that these kind of statements have been made by preachers for a long time that they thought it was coming. We're now actually seeing the mechanisms mm-hmm. be put in place that could be used to do this very thing, our free speech, and especially our religious free speech. So it's much bigger than just Benghazi, and that's what we've talked about in this podcast, but it's really about the freedom of our faith.
Our web bonus material is always a continuation of the discussion from our hour-long radio program. If you would like more information about Understanding the Times Radio, please contact us at Olive Tree Ministries, Post Office Box 1452, Maple Grove, Minnesota 55311, or call our office at 763-559-4444. Our website contains all of our media products and the online store where many of our guests have their books. That web address is olivetreeviews.org. Understanding the Times Radio is a production of Olive Tree Ministries, Maple Grove, Minnesota.